retired state trooper, former NBA referee, author, and the recipient of the prestigious Roosevelt Award. That's one heck of a ride. Thanks for calling in, my friend Bob Delaney. What's going on, Bob?
All good. Life is good.
Did I nail everything you've completed? Because it's a hell of a list.
Yeah. So I was a New Jersey state trooper for 14 years. Three of those years I was undercover, living another persona and running a trucking company in New Jersey along the waterfront. And then for 10 years after that, I was still a state trooper and processing all I was going through. And basketball was my therapy, and I did. I ended up in the NBA as an NBA referee for 24 years. Then for 4 years, I was in management as the vice president, referee operations, director of officials. And currently, I'm with the Southeastern Conference as the special advisor for officiating development performance. So I tell everybody, I can't keep a job. I just bounce from one thing to another.
Let's talk about the amazing award you just got, the 2020 Theodore Roosevelt Award winner. Explain to everyone what this award means, because, Bob, previous winners, astronaut John Glenn, President Bush, President Ford, Arnold Palmer, John Wooden, Staubach, that's a heck of a list.
Yeah, very humbling, for sure. Mike, my fifth grade teacher would have never predicted this. And so I was nominated by my alma mater, New Jersey City University. Ira Thor was the assistant athletic director, nominated me, and I was selected. And like you said, the list goes on. It's 67 people prior to me have been awarded this Teddy Roosevelt, President Teddy Roosevelt Award. And it's at the NCAA's highest award. It's a person that played at the collegiate level and then went on to what has been described as a distinguished life. And like I said, humbling, powerful, exciting, all those kinds of things. And it was a great event that was held in Anaheim, California last month where I was given that award.
Is it like the Heisman Award winner when all the old winners are there or no?
No. No, it's there's 10 other young folks who just graduated from college that are given awards for what they have started to do in their lives.
Okay.
And then there's an inspiration award, and Rocky Blyer got that award.
Oof.
If you remember the great Rocky Blyer, and to be able to spend time with him. And then Stuart Sink was given an anniversary award. And another doctor was given an award for her. It was Dr. Carla Ainsworth for the work that she did. And she played at Kenyon College. She was a swimmer and diver, but has gone on to do amazing work in the medical field. And it was just one person after another with a story. Darren Eels. I don't know if you remember Darren.
I do not.
But Darren played soccer, but he's now the president of the Atlanta United Football Club in the Major League Soccer. And Rebecca Lobo. So
there were some heavy hitters there.
Yes, yeah, of awards. And then the Teddy Roosevelt Award is the last one that's given out as the highest award. So there's like about 14 awards given at this dinner, and recognizing people that have played collegiate sports and have gone on to do other things in life.
Now, we were going to try to do this last month, but you went to Italy. Was Italy like an anniversary, or it was Italy a celebration of this award? How was Italy?
Yeah, Italy was for I'm back in school. I believe that you have to continue to learn. I'm now a student again at Harvard University's Global Mental Health Trauma Recovery Program. You know the work that I do with trauma and recovery, with law enforcement, military, firefighters, first responders. I've been doing that for 4 decades. And so I constantly want to be able to be exposed to the new ideas in this field. So I was one of 70 in a cohort that the first 2 weeks are lectures, classes, projects while we're in Orvieto, Italy. And then it's a 6-month program, and we'll finish up in May. And probably have a get-together up at Harvard University.
Well, I'm glad you brought up law enforcement, because I can't tell you how many police officers approached me. They know I have this podcast, and they said they watched you speak a few weeks ago, and you got to get him on. You got to see what he's doing now. He's talking about with military, first responders. He's helping everyone on the mental aspect of the job. And I'm like, dude, I know that guy. That's Covert. My years infiltrating the Rob. I read your book a while ago. Can you give a brief synopsis of that book? Because I love that book, and that's what put you on my radar.
Yeah. So Covert, My Years Infiltrating the Mob, is a book that was written about my life. And it takes it from me being a kid going into the state police and how basketball was a big part of my life. And I played basketball and baseball at the high school and college level, and then went into the state police in New Jersey, was asked if I was interested in doing an undercover job. I said yes. They told me it was a 6-month job, like we were going to end organized crime in the state of New Jersey in 6 months or something. I don't know what the heck they think. But went on for close to 3 years of my life. I became I infiltrated the Genovese and Bruno crime families. I was the president of a trucking company called Alamo Transportation. There were three FBI agents and two other state troopers involved in the undercover job. I was the president of the company, and so I get to spend a lot of time with the informant, who was a guy by the name of Pat Kelly, who was involved with the Bruno crime family, and he walked me into a lot of places, and I developed the relationships, and we locked up close to 100 people in this job over the years, and put away some significant organized crime figures. So it had an impact, but the impact that was greater was on me, because everybody was telling me I was this tough guy and that I could, because I infiltrated the mob and I was getting awards and being paraded around. I testified before the United States Senate, gave a briefing to Congress. All these kinds of things are going on. And yet inside, I knew I felt like a hypocrite, because the entire time I was undercover, I was scared to death. Yet people were telling me I was something that I didn't believe I was. So this roller coaster ride of emotions was going on inside of me. And the only thing that gave me a peace was like being on a basketball court. So I couldn't play anymore. So I started refereeing. And one thing led to the other and opened up the door for me to get to the NBA. But that story of Covert, I think, is more a story of, while so many people relate to it when I tell the story, I say it because it's not my story. It's our story. Anybody that's been in these kinds of positions as a cop, a firefighter, military, first responder, you know that people make you out to be bigger and badder than you are, because you're just the person doing a job to the best of your abilities. And you're scared to death too. But what I came to understand is that courage is doing things in spite of the fear that you're feeling. And all too often we confuse that. And, you know, I was painted out to be this tough guy, as I said, excuse me. But they didn't see me at 2 o'clock in the morning walking around my house with my service revolver out, pushing shower curtains back because I was afraid they were coming to get me.
So, Bob, did you know you were going through PTSD, or did that impact your life? Because, you know, when people go undercover, oh, that's my new thing. You know, these guys, oh, I'll do a movie role and I'm Jim Morrison. Right. Did you realize, because you were a young dude, did you realize you were going through PTSD while it happened or immediately afterwards, or no?
No. What happened was post-traumatic stress disorder wasn't even a diagnosis then. That didn't come to 1980. So this was the late 70s. So I started going around speaking at different police academies, telling them about the undercover job. And I happened to run into Hank Campbell, who was my psychology professor at New Jersey City University. And he and I started doing some informal therapy. He was the first one that said to me, Bobby, what you're going through is post-traumatic stress. They said, hey, get the hell out of here. What are you talking about, post-traumatic stress?
You're a tough cop, of course, yeah.
Yeah. But I'm also thinking that's a military thing. I'm hearing about guys coming home from Vietnam. Mm-hmm. That's not me. I'm a state trooper. I can handle this stuff. And it wasn't until I got to talk to one of the guys that was on a security detail for me, because there were death threats, I started to notice that there was something different about me. And I have to go out and do surveillances or testify in grand juries early on when I had the security team on me after I surfaced from doing the undercover work. And John Stroth was a detective who had a background in psychology from Rutgers University. And for something I wanted to get over and get away from, the undercover work.
Yeah.
I was going back to being that guy. I was going in to testify with the leather jacket on, with the chains and the pinky ring. And the prosecutors are like, we can't put you on the stand. You look more like them than them. I mean, it's like, so I wanted to go back to what was my new normal, right? I wanted to just be like, feel comfortable. And what was comfortable was Bobby Covert, not Bob Delaney. So it was fading back and forth. And if we stopped out at a bar after a surveillance or something, mm-hmm. I'd start buying everybody drinks. And because that's what Bobby Kotick did when he was in an undercover job. And John Schroth, the detective, said to me, "Pal, what are you doing? That's not Fed money anymore. That's mortgage money. You're hurting yourself."
Wow.
And I pushed myself away from anybody that was willing to talk to me. Louis Free was a street agent at the time, worked in the FBI, became the 15th director of the FBI, if you remember. But Louis knew my investigation, had worked on it, also knew Joe Pistone. He introduced me to Joe Pistone, Donnie Brasco.
Of course.
And after the first time I talked to Joe back in the day, I looked in his eyes, I read his body language. He knew what I was going through. And that was my first introduction to peer-to-peer conversations. I used to call it peer-to-peer therapy, but I remove every medical-sounding term because, from my view, we've over-medicalized this subject, and we are scaring people away from it. It's been around forever. Sophocles wrote two plays about the warrior not knowing how to act after coming home from battle. We called it soldier's heart. After the Civil War, it was called shell shock after World War One, battle fatigue after World War Two. After the Vietnam and Korean Wars, it was referred to as flashbacks. So this is not something new. This is not a mental condition. It's a human condition. It's, human beings go through these things. Post-trauma is inescapable. We have trauma in our lives. There is going to be a post-trauma. How we interact with that, and if we have education and awareness about it, I believe we can interact with it even stronger, because we've done it with HIV AIDS, we've done it with alcohol, we've done it with drugs. Mm-hmm. Education and awareness works. The more that we talk about this. So my belief is that as part of training for every cop, they need to know about post-traumatic stress.
And they need to know
we're
it's
putting
okay.
Them where, yeah, because we're putting them where trauma is. They go to trauma. Military goes to trauma. We've got to create the training, the same way you know how to assault a building, the same way you know how to hit a house, the same way you know how to break down a weapon, you should know about post-traumatic stress.
And you know, Bob, they always say, no one ever calls 911 when they win a lottery or it's something good. You're always
exactly.
Going to someone at the worst of the worst. And that leads me to your book, Surviving the Shadows, A Journey of Hope into Post-Traumatic Stress. When did that come out? Where can everyone get it? And I'm pretty sure the title of the book and what we're talking about describes it. Why was this book so important for you to write?
Yeah, it was the second book I wrote. It's called Surviving the Shadows, as you said. And the reason I call it Surviving the Shadows is that I believe we all have shadows in our lives. And I tell folks, never fear a shadow. Because if there's a shadow, that means there's light nearby. It's our responsibility to ourselves and to each other to help ourselves to that light. So Surviving the Shadows is a group of stories from cops, firefighters, military personnel who have gone through post-traumatic stress experiences, share their stories in hopes, because I believe the trauma story helps people understand their personal story, because what is personal is universal. There are no new emotions in this world. It's just about how do we navigate them. But there's also chapters by doctors that I've worked with that help us understand the medical and the psychological impact of post-traumatic stress on our lives. And when I said it's not a mental illness, what I'm saying is that going through the post-traumatic experience is not a mental illness. What can happen is mental illnesses, depression, different kinds of anxieties, all can potentially come about if left unattended. So our responsibility, I stopped calling it post-traumatic stress about 3 years ago. I call it operational stress. The cops that you talk to, I was speaking at the NYPD Police Academy, mm-hmm. and we called it an operational stress education and awareness, because I believe words matter. When we say post-traumatic stress disorder, we're talking about a diagnosis, and we're scaring people away for having a subject about human emotions. By calling it operational stress, I hire more often than not. Yes, sir. Yeah, I can see that, sir. I have operational stress. Why? Because we're operational. We're doers. We're constantly involved. So if you use words that make sense to those who serve, it opens the door for the conversation.
And they always say the two most comforting words in English language are "me too." So once you hear someone else has it, someone else wants to talk about it, opens the discussion, open the dialogue, and therefore we can get a little better, right?
Exactly, Mike. Exactly.
Bob, where'd you grow up originally?
I'm a Paterson, New Jersey guy. I grew up in Paterson, New Jersey. I went to New Jersey City University in Jersey City. I lived down the Jersey Shore during the times that I was a state trooper. Then I moved to Florida and been bouncing around. I did live in New York City during the time that I was the vice president referee operations for the NBA across the street from the United Nations on 48th Street. So I was in the most protected area of the world, the New York City Police Department. I've had the honor to work with police departments around the world, and I tell folks all the time, New York City Police Department is the best police department I've ever worked with. Amazing men and women serving on that department.
What made you want to become a good guy and join the state troopers?
My dad was a trooper.
Oh, so just
I grew up in a house, and it never struck me as a kid. I didn't want to be what my dad was. Mm-hmm. I mean, to me, that was a scary job. And, like I said, I'm no tough guy. And I'm like looking and saying, this is crazy, man. And you're stopping cars and going into people's houses. That's not for me. I thought of myself as being a high school teacher and a basketball coach was probably where I was going. And then for some reason, about my sophomore year in college, I had this urge to serve. And it was about seeing this as service to the state of New Jersey, service to the community. And it was such a draw to me that I left in my senior year because the state police had not given a test in 2 years. And I was afraid if I stayed another year in college and they didn't give a test for 2 or 3 years, I'd miss out. And so I left in my senior year. I tell the players in the NBA, I was like them. I came out early. The difference is I came out early to be a cop, not to play in the NBA.
Jersey State Troopers, some of the best, most intimidating and sharp-looking uniforms in the country. But you got to tell the history of the shield, because I love the history of the shield of the state troopers that won on the hat. What's so special about that?
Yeah, so the New Jersey State Police was founded in 1921. By Colonel H. Norman Schwarzkopf, the father of the famed General H. Norman Schwarzkopf of the Gulf Wars. And so General Schwarzkopf, we knew, you know, as a major and as a lieutenant colonel and colonel, he would be around the state police representing his father. We have Schwarzkopf's everything. We got Schwarzkopf awards. We got Schwarzkopf buildings. And it's such an honoring of the colonel who started it, but also the pride that we have of his son. And that outfit, as you said, has been... He was a West Point guy. He brought all the West Point kind of training down to the state police at Seagirt, New Jersey. Well, first at Trenton, New Jersey. West Trenton, New Jersey is where the first training took place. But that uniform is a very military style uniform. And back in the day, it was boots and breeches with the long overcoat. They looked like German stormtroopers coming at you, mm-hmm. asking for your license and registration. But the shield is different than most departments because ours is on our hat. It's a hat badge, and it's a triangle, and it's honor, duty, and fidelity are the different points of the hat. And that is what is taught to you in the academy. It becomes part of your DNA in that organization. It's 23-week resident training. When I went through, I think it's longer now because they get off on the weekends, or at least a day. But it's an intense resident training, and the disciplines that are instilled there and the values that are instilled, I know served me to this day today. I mean, I look back, it was sitting across the dining room table from my parents, being raised by a village with my grandparents, aunts and uncles, and the New Jersey State Police that gave me the values that carried me throughout my life and carried me through that undercover job. Because working undercover, I tell people, it's like being, you know, when you're on the street, it's like being in a toilet. And if you stay in a toilet long enough, you're going to start to stink. You need to have your morality, that sense of knowing that you understand right from wrong, because you can start blending things and start rationalizing and start going in down a path that maybe you can justify in your mind that can take you to bad places. And, cops understand what I'm talking about when I say those kinds of things.
You're this young, strapping state trooper, 1 to 2 years on the job. And I know up here in New York, that's some crappy foot post or a traffic detail. How'd you get the opportunity to get this insane undercover gig? Like, how'd they sell this to you, Bob?
Yeah, what happened was it was a heck of a gig back then. We worked 2 days on and 2 days off as troopers. We lived at the stations. We were local cops for towns that didn't have their own police department, as well as doing miles and smiles on the highway, giving out tickets and handling the accidents. So my first station was Flemington, then I went up to Newton. Every 6 months you got transferred. My third station was Somerville Station. And, you know, tell folks, you start getting cocky with a year on the job.
Yeah.
You think you got this thing down, right? You know, you look back at yourself and you're a fool. But I walked in after 2 days off, and there was a note. Every state police station looked the same. You walked in, it was a police station, but on the second and third floor were bedrooms where troopers lived. So it was two troopers every room. And then downstairs was our kitchen, TV room. It was a house, pretty much like a firehouse. And I walked in after 2 days off into the squad room. And you know how they try to make you feel good about yourself, Mike, right? You got a cubby hole with your name on it, like that's your office. And I walked over to my cubby hole and I got a note to call Lieutenant Jack Liddy, Division Headquarters, Criminal Investigation Section, Organized Crime. This guy had more titles next to his name than I ever heard. And it wasn't common for a general road duty trooper to get a call from division headquarters. And Mike, I grew up Irish Catholic. Mm-hmm. That means I wake up guilty in the morning. I thought I did something wrong. I thought I had a problem on my hands. I'm like, older guys are like, relax, kid, give the guy a call. You give a ticket to him.
You're thinking of every ticket you've given him. Oh my God, did I give his mom a ticket? Did I do this? Everything you possibly.
Exactly.
Yes, okay. Exactly. So you give the call.
Yeah, because it's true. So the vets say, relax, kid. Give the guy a call. You probably gave a ticket to a mob guy who works here in an ice pond. I called him. He said, you're going to be in for a while. I said, yes, sir. He said, I'll meet you down in the kitchen about an hour and a half. Troopers, you know how every cop can talk to another cop?
Of course.
It's really every profession can talk to another person in that profession and understand it.
Mm-hmm.
So when he said the kitchen, I know he means in the station downstairs. So about an hour and a half later, I walk in, there's this intimidating figure. Lieutenant Liddy is about 6'4", got meat hooks for hands, the kind of guy that hangs on his lapels when he talks to you. He's also the kind of guy that the button on the shirt has never met the hole on the shirt, right? He's wearing a 16 when it should be a 22. And he looks at me and he talks to me for a few minutes, and then he says, you interested in doing undercover work? I said, yes, sir. He said, and he turns and walks away. I said, Lieutenant, what is it, drugs, narcotics? And back then, all we're doing is buy bust on the street. He said, you keep asking questions, you're going to be out of the running. Over the next 3 weeks, I learned that the President's Organized Crime Task Force, the FBI, New Jersey State Police were joining forces. We were going to start our own trucking company on the waterfront in New Jersey. I became one of those undercover guys. And that took me on a path to where we are today.
I want to know, this is more of like a law enforcement question. How'd you quote unquote resign? Because you weren't like, oh, I'm going to wear plain clothes today. You legit resigned from the troopers. How does that happen? How do you check in? How do you get paid? How does all that stuff happen?
Yeah, it was a very complicated operation and very sophisticated for being in the 70s, to be honest. And it was a lot of money being thrown at it. It was over $1 million grant. So $1 million in 1975 is a major commitment by the law enforcement community. What had happened was in the state police, there's a personnel order that comes out every day, either announcing a variety of things. It's the Bible. And on April 9th, 1975, it was announced that I had resigned from the New Jersey State Police. I left the station in the middle of the night. Lieutenant came up, got my gear. Normally you would sign out on the book. Mm-hmm. No signing out. I'm just gone. And, you know how cops are. I mean, nobody's going to let the truth get in the way of a good story.
The rumors started flowing.
Exactly. So you almost didn't have to start your own thing. I mean, they had me locked up. And it didn't. And people are hard pressed to understand in today's society because there was no social media, there was no Googling. Information came by teletype, so it was easier to do this kind of thing back then. You could hide. You could hide in plain sight. And I took on the identity of a child that died at birth. As most people probably are aware that
I was going to ask Bob though, because that's the worst undercover name ever. It's covert, so I thought it was. I don't know if it was a joke or a play on words.
Becomes a play on words in the 2000s. Mm-hmm. But early on, I took on the identity of a child that died at birth. If you go to the birth records and death records, they're not cross indexed in our country. So if you go to the death records and you find someone with the same first name, same ethnic sounding last name, and age grouping. So we found Robert Allen Covert. Covert can be Irish, could be German.
Mm-hmm.
I grew up Irish Catholic. You know, the TV kind of undercover stuff where you become somebody else and you start acting like you're someone. No, that doesn't work. Mm-hmm. You got to be who you are. Allow your own persona to show up in the undercover persona because that's what you know and that becomes more real. We wanted the first name to be the same. So in case I'm walking down the street and somebody says, hey, Bob, at least if I'm with the bad guys, it's somebody saying Bob, it's the first same name. When you're saying a different first name, it can cause problems. So these were all the concerns and thoughts that were going through our head when we're putting this together. It just so happens it becomes covert, because back then nobody used the word covert. Everybody was called they were narcs, right? They were 007s, they were street guys, there were special detectives, special investigation. It was those kinds of terms that were used around this kind of work. And so it, later in life, after I surface and post Watergate, and the word covert starts becoming more popular. It becomes a military term and then transfers over into law enforcement. And it makes for a catchy story with this undercover job, because everybody thinks we were trying to be cute or funny, but it was really nothing like that.
How long into the operation till it became fruitful, and how'd the mob actually approach you?
Yeah, the first couple months were horrible. We did absolutely nothing. And you know, I said very quickly that it was the President's Organized Crime Task Force out of Washington, the FBI and New Jersey State Police joining forces. Mm-hmm. You can imagine how smoothly that thing ran.
Of course, you got all these, well-oiled machine.
yeah, exactly. It's everybody's fighting for a position. I'm not going to listen to an FBI guy. The FBI guy's not going to listen to me. We're fighting over who's going to open up the trucking company in the morning. That's the important stuff to us. Like, we're all trying to have a pecking order. And it wasn't until we became a team, until we all like started working together. And then we got lucky in the investigation. Like every cop knows, you get lucky. Mm-hmm. A guy by the name of Pat Kelly, who I mentioned earlier, was a concierge with the Giorgio crew of the Bruno crime family. Jammed up. The feds had cases on him. State had cases on him. He's either going to go to jail or come to work for us. He came to work for us. And he's the one that schooled us in a way, this wise guy, right? Because our first trucking company was Mid-Atlantic Air Sea Transportation. And it was on 941 Fairmont Avenue in Elizabeth, New Jersey, at the entrance to the Port of Newark. We had one 16-foot truck, a van, and a station wagon, and we were wondering why organized crime is not knocking on our doors, right? It's a big operation of cops, but it's nothing to the world. And so Pat sat down, and we were five co-owners, the three FBI agents and myself and the other trooper. We listed ourselves as five co-owners of the trucking company because we were being politically correct. Mm-hmm. And Pat said, what are you guys doing with this trucking company? He said, I never saw the bus going down the street with five bus drivers. Somebody's got to be in charge. So it was deemed we'd start a new trucking company in the shadows of a Statue of Liberty on Communipaw Avenue in Jersey City. I became the president. The other undercovers took on roles within the trucking company. And Pat Kelly became the vice president. And we got two new partners. The Genovese and Bruno crime families were kicking back 25%. Our trucks were making three runs to everybody else's, one run down on the Port of Newark. And at one point, we had close to 20 trucks hauling for us around the country.
The crux of this interview is, you know, PTSD and what it can do and how you can help. Mentally draining, I couldn't even imagine what you're going through. Were you able to have any relationships with, you know, females or even friends at this point? Or was it just an all blur to you?
Yeah, it was all a blur. I mean, there were relationships that were so far distant and off to the side. But I wasn't able to go home. I wasn't able to, you know, it wasn't only me. The other undercover is the same thing. It was like, but at least we had each other, right? So you had that sense of a team that was taking place. And that was an important part of it, as well as Lieutenant Liddy was our point person. And he had a business, an undercover business in Newark, New Jersey, that made sense for us to go. If you went into that office, it looked like a regular office, but behind the scenes, he had it set up where he could listen to what was going on in a trucking company. I mean, the electronic surveillance was off the charts for that time frame. Just to give you an example, I could, because it was all payphones back then, right? No cell phones. Mm-hmm. I would go to a payphone. I dial an 800 number. It would come on and say, a recording would come on and say, this is a non-working number. Please hang up and call again. I wait about 15 seconds. I put in a coded number that would activate the recording devices in the trucking company.
Wow.
So that I could have a consensual recording without having to have a wire on my body. And so they had taken all the walls down in the trucking company. The FBI and New Jersey State Police electronic surveillance units came in the middle of the night, took all the walls down. Same thing in my apartment, which, you know, it sounds great, but you're very careful about what you're doing in apartments. you know everything is on tape and you know everything is being watched. So everybody thinks I had a great time. It wasn't a great time, trust me.
finishing up on your mob life, how long, I know you said 3 years operation, how many arrests, what was the outcome of everything?
Yeah, the first hit took down about 30 on a raid in New Jersey, and then there were hits that were taking place in New York and Philadelphia, Florida, up into New England, even in Canada. And so over the course of this investigation, I stayed with it probably for another 5-6 years, where that was my sole responsibility, either testifying in court cases, grand juries, trials, breaking down transcribing and doing all that kind of work. So, and then the spinoff cases that came, because you know how this works.
One guy's
somebody's
flipping,
become
yep.
another informant.
Of course.
Right? I mean, we're going to flip and flip and flip. And that's all we kept doing. Everybody's a tough guy until they get in the back the back office of the police station. And then everybody's going to, they're all talking. Everybody wants to tell you a story.
Hey, Bob, how about the best scam the mob had that actually impressed you, that you're thinking, holy crap, that's actually a good idea?
Oh, they had amazing stuff. Like, they came to me one time and wanted me to buy a tow truck, and that we'd paint it. They said we'd only do this for about a week, but we'd score. And we'd paint it into the official police towing truck of Newark, New Jersey. And we go around to all the locations where the businessmen are, and taking those two-hour lunches. And we'd hook up all the Cadillacs and the big cars and take it down the road. And they said, you can imagine that the cops will be stopping traffic for us because they'll see the local police towing truck pulling these things out of here. We'd be stealing cars left and right. The same thing when the Meadowlands opened up. If you know, you're too young, but the Meadowlands, when it first opened up, had valet parking out front with guys in yellow jumpsuits that said valet.
And well, they wore the valet stuff, guys, I bet.
Wise guys put in some young Turks up there in those yellow jumpsuits. They would only go pick up the cars that were like the high end cars. They'd be out on Route 46 before you know it, being pulled down the road. I mean, their minds are always about scamming, and it's always about figuring out how can we make a score. And but you know, on the waterfront with all the containers that were there back in the day, it's all computerized now. But back then, it was in a book; it was being moved from one part to another. That thing would be gone for about a month before law enforcement even knew it was stolen.
How mentally can you go back to regular uniform work? If you did, you go back to regular uniform work?
No, I was made a detective afterwards and worked in organized crime bureau. I would put the uniform on because it was important to me.
Sure.
I was looking for every reason to put the uniform on. It reconnected me back to that organization, to the values. You know, that's what's pretty good about being a uniform cop. That uniform can represent a lot of positive things for you. And so, you know, for an FBI agent, they really don't have anything other than their credentials. And so I always felt for those guys, because us putting back that uniform and being in 200, 300 other people with that uniform on gave you an understanding of what you were part of. And so that was important to me. But I did detective work in organized crime. Then I went into the Intelligence Bureau. And my last year, as I was at the State Police Academy, I ran in the Criminal Science Unit, I ran the Institute on Organized Criminal Groups. We expanded from traditional organized crimes and went into gangs and motorcycle gangs and street gangs. And it became more aware that organized crime was well beyond the traditional organized crime, the mafia, La Cosa Nostra, or whatever term you want to give to it.
I want to talk quickly about your MBA career, because most cops I know retire and they either relax or they do a little security gig. You decide to go ref, but you don't ref high school. You go right, you climb the ranks, go to the NBA. How about the first time you're in an NBA arena officiating with the bright lights? What's your welcome to the NBA moment as a referee?
Yeah, I was a referee at the high school, and then I moved into the summer pro league. So I was working at Jersey Shore for summer pro league when Daryl Garrettson, the director of officials for the NBA at the time, saw me, offered me a position in the Continental Basketball Association, which was the minor leagues, now called the G League. So after 2 years there, I was offered a position full time, and my mother was all panicked, because, like, you're going to give up your pension. I don't want to hear about you giving up your pension. So I vested my pension to make her happy in the event the NBA thing didn't work out, that I would go back to the state police. And so I get my payment once a month from the state of New Jersey with my pension. But the NBA gig opened up with me in 1987. And what was cool, Daryl Garrison knew I was from New Jersey at the time, you know, made sure that my first game was at Madison Square Garden.
Wow.
There were only two referees. My mom and dad were there, oh. My sister and family members. So it was a great experience. And over the course of time, though, you came to learn that when you're a referee, just like your cops, sometimes you're out there by yourself.
Mm-hmm.
It was a game. My mother loved the Knicks and loved Patrick Ewing. And I called horrible foul on Patrick Ewing one game. And I guess like the little boy in me looked up. She was sitting in the stands. We had really good seats underneath the hoop. And I look up and she's waving her hands at me like that was a bad call. It's like your own mother turns on you in this business.
So I'm glad we talked about NBA. You did over 1,000 games. You did NBA finals games and everything, right?
Yeah, over 1,500 NBA games, 210 playoff games, 9 finals, 2 All-Stars, refereed in China, Japan, Dominican Republic, NBA games all over the world.
Now, I want to fast forward because we're having a lot of fun, but I want to talk about something really, really serious because the role you do when you speak to first responders, military, all those people is you talk about the suicide thing. It's rampant with law enforcement, military. Your book, or what else can we do to help that? Because it is everywhere. That's all you read. You know, military guy home kills himself, police officer kills himself. What do you think is causing, you know, I guess the abundance of it right now?
I think there's a couple of things that are taking place. And I tell a story in my book, Surviving the Shadows, of a suicide that takes place. And the hardest thing I ever did, 5 years after the suicide took place, Jim Gallagher, a gunny sergeant, a Marine, 17 years, an amazing, great American. His wife, Mary, they're kids from the suburbs of New York. And just a great American story. Jim comes home after a deployment in Iraq. They're stationed in Pendleton at the time. Mary takes the kids to Disney. They come back. They found Jim hung himself in the garage of their home. I wanted to tell that story because I think it's important. My belief is that many times those who serve find themselves to be a burden to their family, find themselves with all that they're going through and thinking that there is no way that this is ever going to get better, that they do the final intervention on themselves in hopes of making life better for those they love. But I wanted to show and tell the story of what happens after they leave so that any cop, military personnel, firefighter, anyone who serves, sees what takes place to that family. And the hardest thing I ever did for 5 hours, sit at that kitchen table, and 5 years after Jim had committed suicide, have Mary tell that story. But I know it's an important story to tell because that's part of what it is. The other part is I think that this peer-to-peer conversation, this willingness to have open conversation, when we make believe that these things don't bother us, right?
Mm-hmm.
Hey, for my generation of being a cop, and I'm sure it still goes on today, when he sees tough stuff, we make jokes about it.
Yeah.
And I get that part of it. That's part of being able to get through it. But then it's go to the bar and drink it away. And, or in some cases, unfortunately, use drugs to mm-hmm. push it away. You know, this self-medication is causing for things to spiral out of control. And also, it's no secret, cops have on their hip the final intervention.
Uh-huh.
And
it's instantaneous. Yeah,
exactly. Oh. It's quicker. It's there. So these are areas, but we've got to talk about it, Mike. Like shows like yours,
mm-hmm.
like the academies. This is stuff we've got to talk about when you first come in, not about 10, 15 years later. It's got to be part of what a rookie's going through,
mm-hmm.
of understanding. And the old timers got to be willing to tell their stories. Because their stories are powerful and rich in understanding how they process. And if they process it in a wrong way, that's okay to talk about too, because that's helping somebody understand. You learn from positive and negative. You can learn from negative as well. This is not going to help you, man. Sitting around drinking a freaking six-pack
mm-hmm.
on a ride home and then sitting down with a bottle of Jack in order to get through what you saw that day, that's not going to make it better. It's only going to make it worse.
How about this? How about some characteristics people are affected by that maybe family and friends and coworkers can look out for?
Yeah, I think there's a withdrawn, you know, obviously the telltale signs of post-trauma are paranoia, anger levels increase, frustration levels increase, withdrawal from being around anybody. You know, it's easy in our society today. I just get on my computer, right, and I look like I'm busy, mm-hmm. but I've withdrawn and I'm not talking to anybody. This willingness to have the conversations, the willingness to listen to people, that's what's important. We've gotten away from that. You know, I've been involved in this thing for four decades, as I've told you, and the studies that have gone on. Some of the studies that have taken place is, what's the difference between today's military and World War II? Well, in World War II, they were on ships coming home for months. They were processing with each other in conversation what they went through before they get home. Today, 36 to 48 hours, you're off the Main Street Baghdad or Main Street Kandahar, and you're mm-hmm. on Main Street USA. There's no processing taking place. A cop after, I had this happen after talking to cops and firefighters on the pile in 9/11. One firefighter got all pissed off at me and said, "What do you want me to do? You want me to talk to the guy next to me?" He says, "You want to know what my day is like? My day is 12 hours on that pile." And he says, "I get off the pile and I drive home and I'm in that car for 40 minutes and I cry the entire time. And then when I pull in the driveway, I turn off the tears, I put on the face, and I give that strength look because I don't want my family to be afraid." Oof. And I think every cop and every firefighter understands what I just said. We hide our emotions. And I'm not saying we go home and say, tell everything, mm-hmm. but we have to have some safe place to be able to let our emotions out. Mike, I'm going to give you a quick analogy. Mm-hmm. When I do this kind of presentation, I ask people to imagine that I had a balloon in front of the room full of air. How do I get the air out? I take a pin, I pop it, I get the air out, but I don't have a balloon anymore. I let it go. It flies all over the room, goes out the back door. We don't know what happened to the balloon. Mm-hmm. But if I'm patient and willing to listen to sounds I don't want to hear, and I turn it upside down, a little air out of the balloon, makes that screeching noise. I don't want to hear that. But eventually I'm going to get all the air out of the balloon. I'm going to have a full balloon I can use again one day. That's us with trauma. We need to get the air out of our balloons. There has to be a willingness to tell your story. You have to be willing to tell somebody else, because when you tell somebody else your story, you're validating their feeling and giving them permission to tell you their story. We need to get the air out of our balloons.
Perfectly said, and I've kept you for 42 minutes. So we're going to finish up quick with some quick hit questions. You ready to roll?
Yes, sir.
Best Jersey Shore town?
Spring Lake.
Ooh, really pretty one. How about best cop movie of all time?
I got to go with Donnie Brasco. Kidding me? Joe will be upset if I don't.
Best basketball movie of all time?
Oh, best basketball movie. What was it called?
Hoosiers?
Hoosiers.
Of course.
I couldn't even think of it. Yeah, okay.
Here we go. Any memorabilia you kept from the game?
Oh, there's tons of us. I'm in my office now. You know, I'm looking at my referee jerseys, framed. I've got basketball from David Stern signed to me. I've got the last game that I had of basketball all signed by the referees. And then I've got pictures of Kobe and Michael. And there's one here with Jerry Sloan and Karl Malone and John Stockton.
I'm an NBA.
Phil Jackson, Larry Bird.
You got it all.
Patrick Ewing. I'm very fortunate. Very, very fortunate.
We're not going to let you use Donnie Brasco. Best mob movie of all time?
Goodfellas. I think it's one of the more realistic ones.
How about this? Biggest trash talker in the NBA while you played? While you reffed?
Charles Barkley.
Did he complain the most?
No, Danny Ainge complained the most. Danny complained about everything. Danny complained when he walked out on the floor. He was a whiner. No, Charles didn't complain. He would bark. But he always had some great lawn liners. Most of them you can't tell publicly.
Two more. Biggest difference between Bob Delaney and Bobby Covert?
Great question. I think that biggest difference between us, I don't know that there is, to be honest with you. Mm-hmm. I think there's a lot of similarities, and it was because I became that person. The difference with Bobby Cover is that he lived his life in fear, and Bob Delaney doesn't.
Great answer. I like that. That was a really fear. That's a couple times you mentioned fear, and that's what we all have to address. And let's end it with this. You and I hanging out at a bar. Who's the coolest first person in Bob Delaney's phone that if you pulled it out and texted him, they would text you right back?
Shaquille, Charles Barkley.
Well, okay. You
I mean, I can go on here. This is I could if I could scroll that thing. I'm very fortunate. So being in the position as vice president of referee operations changed my interaction with the players and ex-players and announcers, because I had to do a lot of interacting with them. So we developed relationships. Bill Walton wrote the foreword on my book. Covert. And so I've been fortunate to be around a lot of amazing people, but you know, I could go down another list for you of Marty Dempsey, General Marty Dempsey, General Bob Brown, four-star generals. I've been fortunate to be around the great leaders in our society. David Stern, Adam Silver. I work for Greg Sankey now at the Southeastern Conference. What an opportunity for a guy to be, you know, in the twilight. I'm around the third heading to home, right? I mean, let's be real about where life is. But to have the experiences I've had and to be around the folks that I've been around just is amazing.
Bob, this was an absolute pleasure. Please give it all the plugs where everyone can go to your website, buy the book, and hear you speak and hear everything about you. Please give all that now.
Yeah, it's www.delaneyconsultants.com. And they can go to Amazon for the books. My speaking gigs are mostly private organizations, so it's not like I go into a public forum and speak. Most of the times it's in police academies, but I'm doing work with NYPD now, which is tremendous. Like I said earlier, I just am overwhelmed being around the men and women who serve us in every facet of life, whether it be law enforcement, firefighters, first responders, and our military and their families. You know, at times we forget about the families, and they get hit with some of the shrapnel of the post-traumatic stress that that people experience.
Thank you for your service, your time. Congratulations on the award. Go Kentucky. I'm the biggest Kentucky basketball fan who's ever lived. So if you want to make some arrangements, make Kentucky win. Bob, this was a blast, my friend. Thank you so much.
Take care. See you, Mike.
Talk soon, brother.